Great to have you with us on WPR News. Larry Mueller here, taking a look at your work day or your work days here to begin the show. Do you dread going to work on some days or maybe most days? Have you thought about why that is? Wonder what you can do to embrace your job and feel less stressed? Try to answer those questions in this first hour of the show today as we visit with Guy Winch back with us. Guy's a psychologist, author, co-host of the Dear Therapists podcast, and his latest book is what we're going to be talking about, an interesting one. It's titled Mind Over Grind, How to Break Free When Work Hijacks Your Life. And I hope you'll join in as we talk with Guy. Tell us what's bothered you at your workplace, maybe how you dealt with it, or maybe you have a question about how to deal with it. Give us a call, the number 800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234, or you could email us to talk@WPR.org. Guy Winch, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Thank you very much for having me.
At the beginning of your book, Mind Over Grind, you argue that more Americans than ever are feeling a high degree of stress at work. Is this a problem for people with specific professions, or are most jobs unreasonably stressful?
I think these days, what the numbers show is that stress and burnout are peaking in the workplace in general. And I think it goes across, most professions. I mean, I remember the one job I had in life in which I did not stress about my job the second the job was over was when I was waiting tables. I never went home and kind of spent the evening worrying about, oh, I wish I could have served them more quickly or something like that. You know what I mean? There's some jobs that you're done, but most of them are stressful, are difficult, are tense. You know, there are all these things happening now to create uncertainty in the marketplace in so many sectors. So I think it's the majority.
Yeah. Is there a time when stress is beneficial?
When stress is short and acute, then it's beneficial. It's a useful response to have. It warns us when something is coming at us, when there's some kind of danger. If it's a quick thing, then it's fine. The problem with stress today is that it becomes chronic. People can be activated and kind of in fight or flight at work every day because their office politics and people are trying to, you know, step on their turf and they're feuding with this, or they have a difficult boss, or there's harassment going on, or there's just a lot of tension, there are cuts looming, all these things that make people tense and stressed out throughout much, if not most, of the workday, and then it becomes really chronic. We're not really well designed to experience that all day, day after day after day.
Yeah, and then that could result in burnout, I guess. Well, how would you define burnout, by the way?
Burnout is defined by several things. It's, you know, its main feature is this sense of just deep exhaustion, not the kind that a good night's sleep will do away with. You just feel, and I was burnt out earlier in my career. I know this firsthand. You really feel like you're going through the motions. You feel dread at everything. You're disconnected from things. You lose the meaning. You lose the joy. You lose the excitement about what you're doing. You're just trying to get through. There's a real cynicism about your work that comes through. You really lose touch with why it was important, if it ever was, and all those things. And so it really does a very general number. It just turns you into a drone. You're just trying to get through it, but it just with no emotion or satisfaction or meaning behind it.
And obviously that has a toll on your health.
It has a major toll on your health. It has a major toll on your health because when you're really stressed out, it affects your immune system functioning. It predisposes you to all kinds of illnesses, as does burnout. There's a real medical consequence. The World Health Organization estimates that 750,000 people die every year from overworking. You know, and again, they are burnt out, but they're not realizing it. It just can really compromise our health, our functioning, and especially, and this is a lot of what the book is about, our life outside of work. You know, the fact that if you're burnt out at your office, at your work during the day, you're not getting home happy-go-lucky. You're getting home and you're bringing that kind of dullness and that, you know, strain with you. So it really is going to impact your family life and your personal life outside of work.
Yeah, absolutely. Maybe it's a good point to talk about your book. I liked how you sort of organized it by kind of like by days of the week. Well, talk about how you have this organized.
Well, I talk about different topics, and I do organize it by day of the week because each day of the week has its different challenges. You know, Sunday, the challenges, we get the Sunday blues, the Monday scaries, and we start feeling this feeling of dread as the work week approaches. And Monday is usually considered the most stressful and difficult day of the year. It's the day in which cardiovascular events are highest because that, you know, it's like jumping into a cold pool from the relative relaxation of the weekend. Now you go right into it. So that's a difficult day. As the week goes on, day after day, there are different kinds of challenges. And Friday, you have this mix of relief on the one hand because the weekend's coming, but exhaustion on the other. So I just thought it was a good way to organize the book. And I talk about the different challenges on every day and through that lens, the different challenges we all face in the workplace.
Yeah. And the folks you talk about, clients that you probably gave a different name to.
Of course, yes.
But you had me kind of rooting for them through the whole thing. It was a really nice way to use those examples, I think.
Yes, I decided that instead of just, you know, dipping into an example here or there, to follow five people throughout the entire book. We find out what happens to them, you know, and their stories, you know, last throughout the entire book. And then to really bring through their eyes what these issues are, but also what the interventions are, what the tools and techniques are. It's not just here's a problem, here's a tool. It's like here's how that affected them. Here's what the tool is. Here's how they used it. Here are the questions they had about it. I just felt it would be a much more interesting and illustrative way to bring the information to people.
I think you're absolutely right. It was certainly it held my interest and kept my interest going. As I've said, I was rooting for all of them.
Unfortunately, Larry, you always say to me, oh, I really like these characters. When they start the book, I like them. I hope nothing bad happens to them. And yeah. I'm like, well, if nothing bad happened, there really wouldn't be a book here. I mean, obviously, stuff happens. You know?
Yeah, stuff happens for sure. Well, you do argue that our work lives have kind of been hijacked by hijacked our personal lives. And how are employers responding to the decline in workers' mental health? Because we do see that, as you point out.
First of all, I want to point out that, you know, I make a little bit less of a distinction between employer and employee because I work with many employers and they suffer all the same ills of burnout and stress as their employees do. They're not sitting on the beach, you know, sipping Mai Tais, and they're like working really, really hard themselves. And so this should be, you know, this is addressed to them as well. And the problem with that employers have is they're trying to resolve stress and burnout by having programs and resources in the workplace. And it's not working because those stresses are no longer contained to the workplace. We bring them home with us. They affect our thoughts in the evenings. They affect our relationships. They affect our partners and our families, they affect our leisure time, they affect our sense of identity and how we conduct ourselves after work. And employers don't have control of us there. That's in our heads. And so part of my approach with this book is that, you know, yes, regardless of what the stresses are within the workplace, the best you can do is learn how to better manage them there and how to contain them so that they're not spreading and infecting your life outside of work, because they are in all these unconscious ways that most people are unaware of.
Talking today with Guy Winch about his book titled Mind Over Grind, How to Break Free When Work Hijacks Your Life. Has work hijacked your life? Maybe a bit. Questions about it, give a call. The number 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. Or you could email us, the email address, talk@wpr.org. So it's probably not enough, or how you talk about stressful workplaces, maybe they offer mental health resources to its employees. That enough?
I mean, it's great, But A, many employers do not avail themselves of them, and it's not sufficient because, again, what my research found when writing this book is that there's so many ways in which we bring those pressures home with us. Some of those, you know, some of that we're aware of, many of that we're not. And even if we are aware, we don't know how to stop that leakage from really leaking over from work. And by the way, it's not a leak, it's a gush. It gushes over from work into our personal lives, and it really creates an extension of that stress into the evening, into the weekend, and we mismanage it. We're not aware of that we're doing things that are really problematic.
Yeah.
And we don't even know how to recover correctly from the workday, which is, you know, there's a science about that. And so, like, there's so much in this, in so many ways, and we need to become more sophisticated about how we manage ourselves in this culture of a workplace that's highly stressful.
Yeah. Just this past weekend, I was listening to a program. It was an interview, and it was sports related, and it was three NBA players talking about stress in their job and how the NBA had said, "Well, they got together a group and of folks that would deal and talk with and advise and consult with the players," and they said, "Well, they'll never be, you know, we won't know about this and so forth, you know, who's coming." And then one of the guys said, "Did you ever go to one of those?" "Nope." And none of our players would. And they all three said none of them went, and none of their players went, because they figured it's going to get back to management that I'm having some kind of a mental issue, and then I am going to maybe lose my job.
Look, a lot of employees have that concern, right? In other words, that yes, if I avail myself of those resources, HIPAA laws notwithstanding, what if, you know, it, you know, what if that comes back to the management and they'll think, well, I can't handle the stress if I am going to seek help for it. And then you have entire professions that you really can't do that, because that will cost you, you know, pilots, etc. Like, oh, if you're going to get mental health, you know, assistance, then that could really, you know, then it's just not, it's not sanctioned well. And so, like, it is very difficult for people. But regardless of that, you know, like, I think a lot of the damages does happen outside of work, and it happens in, and that's what people need to be alerted to. Even within the workday, we don't take, you know, we're not smart about how we curate the breaks that we take, about how we, you know, manage ourselves during the pressures of a given workday. If you have a critically difficult meeting or a conflictual one, you know, you don't necessarily think to set up 5 minutes to get some emotional support from a colleague, or to do something to kind of, you know, like, get that, you know, get your mindset back to normal after you know you're going to have a very challenging meeting. We don't think to be more proactive and intentional in those ways.
Yeah. Lisa in Appleton has something for us. Let's go there. Lisa, hi. Thanks for calling.
Hey, thanks for taking my call, Larry. Can you hear me all right?
Yeah, you're coming in loud and clear.
Great. Thank you. I'm calling actually on behalf of my 30-year-old son. He and I are very close. He's dealing with, I think, major PTSD. He works for a wonderful company out of Kaukauna called Midwest. You don't need to know the name. It's a restoration company, and he's been there a couple of years. So he's responding to homicides and suicides, and they kind of debrief in that they let the guys, the people, take a day, half a day off if something has really troubled them. But he's also dealing with a lot of chemicals, mold, and who knows what else. They're doing fire restoration and water damage stuff. And he I think, is like his dad and I, where we kind of sort of are putting out this imposter syndrome. We act like everything's totally cool and it's not bothering us on the surface. And then we get alone and we freak out. So my boy's been calling me with panic attacks every time he's on call. And he is getting some behavioral health help now, but these were like paralyzing him. And he would call crying and telling me, "Mom, I can't do it anymore. I have to quit. And I would tell him, "Honey, you know, your job doesn't define you. You go ahead and quit if that's what you need to do. But can I help you get a backup plan? You know, I'll help you go to job service or whatever's out there now." And he's got a great benefit package and just became engaged. So he doesn't want to do that right now, but he's losing it. he's losing it at times, and I think he's got the upper hand. He's relying on his spirituality and reaching out to friends. But other than that, I, as a mother, I don't know what to tell him, you know?
Yeah, yeah. Well, Guy, these are the kinds of things you might deal with over a couple of years' time with a person, but Lisa certainly has, Lisa's son certainly has a tough situation.
He does, but, you know, Lisa, I just want to tell you, you've done everything right over there. What you've said to him is, like, it's okay if this job is not for you, if it's too difficult. I will help you find and think of alternatives. I'm there for you. There's nothing wrong in kind of prioritizing these things. So I think you've said all the right things to him. I'm glad he's getting help now, but it takes a while. The one, you know, quote-unquote good thing about panic attacks, it's a very noticeable symptom. Either those get better or not. In other words, with the help that he's getting, either he can manage and find a way to keep doing his job without getting those kinds of panic attacks. And if he cannot, then he really does need to think very seriously about switching, because I'm glad he's getting engaged, he's getting married, it's good benefits. He's not going to be happy in the marriage or anywhere if he keeps having to deal with these panic attacks. So I'm glad that he's getting the help. But once you have breakthrough symptoms like that, it's a good idea to keep your eye on them and see, now, is this helping? Is it going away? Sometimes it's just not a good match. You know, like that job is just too difficult. It brings up too many traumatic or triggering situations that somebody cannot manage.
Yeah, Lisa, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Guy Winch, our guest today, as we talk with him about his book, Mind Over Grind, How to Break Free When Work Hijacks Your Life. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Taking a look at the workplace, and Guy Winch, our guest, as we talk with him about his book, Mind Over Grind, How to Break Free When Work Hijacks Your Life. And again, you can join in at 800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. You've mentioned this more than once, this whole business of stress at work, it takes itself home.
It very much does. Here are a couple of the findings of the research that really surprised me when I learned about them on the one hand, and yet kind of confirmed what I was seeing in my work with individuals on the other. Number one, there's research that shows that when one person is very stressed and pressured at work, their partner can start to develop symptoms of burnout. Their partner, who's not in that situation, because it's that's how much it spills over and carries over to the home. And another one, which was equally surprising yet not, is that when one person is very, very stressed out at work, their partner can lose their sex drive as a result. And again, surprising in that it transfers that significantly. Not surprising, because when someone comes home stressed and preoccupied and tense, not a turn on for most people. So yes, you might lose your sex drive. It's hard to feel, you know, romantic when the person next to you is in such a, you know, stressed out state. So that's not surprising, but it's just examples of how these things really spill over into the home and how much we bring them home with us. And one last finding is that when we get really, really stressed out at work, it's not just that those stresses will transfer to our partner, we will unconsciously start to undermine them within the home without realizing we're doing it, because we're so checked out, we're so in a different place, we're not noticing that our responses and our behavior are actually problematic and undermining to our partner, because we're that much not present in the home, checked out and somewhere else.
Reggie in Oshkosh, we'll go to you next. Hi, Reggie. Thank you for calling.
Hey, how's it going? I'm on the road in case it cuts out, so I apologize ahead of time.
All right, what's on your mind?
So I haul fuel in Wisconsin, so I'm in my semi a good chunk of the day. I work in all different types of weather. It's very loud in the semi, and, you know, I've got, you know, 7,000-8,000 gallons of fuel behind me all day, or the vapor from it, which is even more dangerous. I get home, and I'm literally vibrating for like a half hour. Just from the noise and the stress, and is there a good way to just, like, calm down? Because I work long days, and the kids and everyone's like, oh, hey, you're home, blah, 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 and I just need to, like, decompress.
Yeah. Well, you certainly talk about this in your book, Guy.
I absolutely do. I mean, first of all, you need to alert your family that I get home, but then when I get home, I need a little bit of time to shift my mindset and to decompress, because you absolutely do. I mean, I think it's a great description. I'm vibrating still from the noise, from the tension, from all of these, you know, the concentration and all of it. So first of all, alert them. The fact that Daddy walks through the door does not mean Daddy is available, you know, for Daddy duties right now. And then find a quiet place. And what I recommend is to develop a transition ritual that helps you shift your mindset from your workday to your home life. And that should include the following ingredients. First of all, music. You know, find a playlist, find songs that help you kind of calm down, shift your mindset, remind you of home, remind you of what it's like to be away from work. Listen to that music. Change your clothes when you get home. Shower, that's sometimes also useful to do because it's quite immersive. But change your clothes, which you probably do, but make sure to do that, into clothes that you associate with being relaxed, with being home. It's very, very noisy where you work. So having some quiet time, maybe get some earplugs or stuff like that, because a house of kids can be noisy as well. But to kind of help your mind learn to kind of, you know, down gear from the gear you're at literally when you're working to a, you know, to the first gear, second gear at most. So use those things. Use the time to kind of quiet your mind. Use a shower to change the clothes. Use music to do it. Use earplugs to do it, to have some quiet if you need to. And do some breathing exercise like box breathing. Box breathing is when you breathe in to the count of four, hold your breath to the count of four, breathe out to the count of four, hold your breath to the count of four, and repeat. It's like a box of four, 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 four. And that will help you regulate your breathing. But you absolutely need a little bit of time to shift your mindset and to calm down so you can be present at home. It's not reasonable to expect you'll be able to like snap your fingers and shift from one mode to another. But ask your family to give you that grace and to give you that time to be a shift. And tell them, if I have that time, I'll be much, much more present and much more enjoyable to be around once I emerge from whatever that solitude place is.
Yeah, and just have that conversation. You need to have that communication, that conversation.
Yes.
Yeah. Reggie, and good luck. I appreciate your call very much. And you've described something that unfortunately is a situation that many folks experience. And so I really appreciate your call. You can join in, too. The number is 800-642-1234. Email to talk at WPR.org. Sue had emailed to say she retired at age 64 as she was concerned about the health impact of her crazy hours as a salaried employee. A single woman with grandchildren, a home to maintain, and wasn't willing to give up her social life and health. But she retired at 64, now approaching 77, very healthy, and no regrets about her current lower income.
Good. You know what? The chapter before last in the book is a chapter about whether to stay or whether to go and what considerations you need to have, like how to know when it is time to leave. And there are a lot of considerations also in terms of where you are in your career, whether you're towards the end, what retirement might look like for you. And absolutely, taking a cut in terms of money, in terms of compensation, limiting, you know, what you might be able to do in that way, and substituting that for a higher quality of life, for less stress, for more health, is a very, very fine consideration indeed. And here's an example of someone who did that math and said, you know what, I will be happier even if I, you know, have less money to live on and I have to cut down in some of the things that I do. I will be happier taking that, you know, cut. And that's true with retirement, and sometimes it's true of switching to another job where the quality of life will be higher.
Yeah, there she is 13 years later, and doesn't regret her decision.
Yeah, great to hear.
One bit. I wanted to bring up emails and as a part of this being at home. I'll tell you one little story. As a professor here at the University of Wisconsin, and you typically have 100 undergraduate advisees to work with, and they all have my phone number, or they know how to get me via email. And I once got I got a call from our department chair, and she said, "Gee, there's a wondering what's going on. I got an email from a student who said he hadn't been able to get a hold of you via email," and I didn't understand it. And so I went and I had gone from work to a meeting. And had been at a meeting, and apparently while I was at the meeting, he sent an email to me at about 5:30 or 6, somewhere in there, and he emailed my department chair at 9 o'clock, 3 hours later, and said, "What's going on? I can't get a hold of Larry." And I was really miffed about that at first. In fact, for a bit, and I had to really think about it, and I had, this kid must be under a lot of stress. I explained to her, right, and she was quite, she knew there was my boss, let's say, the department chair, knew that I'm normally pretty good about emails, but you are, and you report in the book that there's research. I think it's like 70% of professionals or people with a college education have to answer their emails like 24/7.
First of all, your interpretation is very charitable, I would like to say. You know, Larry, like, oh, the poor young man might have been quite distressed. I would have gone with quite entitled. But anyway, let that aside.
Well, first, yeah. I was mad. And then I thought about it.
Fair enough. But look, it's true. And on average, some people, you know, in jobs can do like 8 hours of emails after hours a week. That's an extra day of work. And as a lot of people tell me, the problem is that it's not that I'd have to answer that many. Sometimes I only have to answer two or three emails, except I have to read through 200 of them to figure out which two or three those are. So I'm spending the entire evening checking my phone, checking my phone, checking my phone. Here's the problem with that. It keeps you at work. When you are thinking about work when you're home, you are at work mentally, and you're not at home, for sure. You know, that's when you're checked out. And so there needs to be a way that you can respond to emails, because most employers expect you to do so at some point, but do it in a way that doesn't ruin your time at home. If you're checking your phone every few minutes for emails, you cannot be present in what you're doing at home, and you're going to be in fight or flight, and you're going to be activated and stressed, and that's really bad. That's when the chronic stress can come in and the burnout can come in. The technique I suggest in the book is called red light, green light, and in essence, it's to choose a time in the evening that's convenient for you, that's least disruptive to your plans. Let's say it's 6, 7 o'clock, it's 8 o'clock, whatever the time is, 9 o'clock, depending on your hours. And that during that time, for 15, 20 minutes, half an hour if you need, 5 if it's only 5, that's when you will check and respond to emails. You will not do so before, and you will not do so after. And the way that works is that you want to trick your brain into feeling like you are in control of your time when you're not at work, rather than work is in control of your time at home, because that makes a big difference. And so if you do it that way, you kind of define the evening as the main event, the show. Now, by the way, the show is not fancy. It can be I'm having dinner with my family, then I'm putting the kids to bed, and then I'm watching TV for a bit. We're not talking fancy. But in that constellation, let's say that's the plan, that's my plan for the evening. That's what I want to be present doing. There, between the time of putting the kids to bed and watching a show, or somewhere there, what I decide and let people know ahead of time, I will take an intermission from the show. And that's when I will check and respond to emails. And when you define it that way in your brain, as my main show is my life after hours, I will take an intermission from life to respond to emails, then your brain still feels like you're in control. You have the autonomy to decide how your time goes. And that turns out is really, really helpful for keeping you in a calm state rather than keeping you activated.
Yeah, I really like that approach. That red light, green light is, I think, a great idea when it comes to that situation. Jay in Two Rivers has something for us. Jay, hi.
Good morning and happy election day, gentlemen.
To you as well.
Interesting, the last job that I had before retiring was by far the most toxic job that I ever had in over 50 years of employment. But the upside is I've been happily retired for 12 years, a little earlier than I had expected. And I'm just wondering how often it is that from the top of the executive, the top executives, all of the management, and even the lower supervisors, there's almost nothing I have good to say. And I kept track, and they went through at minimum 125% turnover every year. They had a weekly list on the entrance door of people we should report if we see them that they weren't allowed on the premises. It was just really eye-opening. There's lots of stories, but I'll end it at that.
Oh, my goodness.
Well, you know, that's about workplace culture, right? I mean, in other words, you're describing, you know, you use the word, it's a toxic culture. And the problem with toxic cultures is that they do filter down from the top. And they force everyone to, you know, play by those rules. It's very difficult to insulate yourself from that. If it's such a difficult, challenging, unfriendly, uncaring workplace that they're churning through turnover in that level, and you're saying, like, 50 years of working, I had a lot of comparisons, this one was really out there. And there definitely are companies like that. And what's remarkable to me is that, you know, yes, it does come from the top. And what's remarkable to me is that the people at the top don't seem to realize that they are harming themselves, they are shooting themselves in the foot. Because the turnover is going to cost you a lot of money to rehire, to retrain people is very, very expensive, number one. They're not going to be that productive. You are forcing them to spend so much of their mental energy managing stress, managing hostility, managing toxicity, they're going to have just less left over with which to actually do their jobs. The irony of all of this is that it actually benefits both employer and employee to have kinder, more caring workplaces, because you get much more out of your people, quote unquote, when they actually care, when they're engaged, when they're not operating by fear. So it's just so, so unfortunate. But that's a great example. Even the example you gave about their lists for, like, report them if they're on the premises. I mean, it feels like, you know, release the hounds. Why don't you? I mean, it's that kind of place. I'm glad you left.
How risky is it for employees to challenge situations like that, or maybe not that extreme, but just challenging uncaring bosses or complain about being overworked?
That too depends on culture, because there's some workplaces in which you might have a boss that's difficult, an incident that happened. I mean, those things can happen. And in some cultures, in some workplace cultures, it's okay to challenge them, to go to HR, etc. And yet in others, that will be a very dangerous thing to do. They might have to go through the motions, but HR is always caught, because they always, you know, they are supposed to represent you, but they also have to protect the company they work for. So they're always in a bind. You know, like they have certain edicts that they have to do, but there are always pressures on them as well. And if they're too lenient or too pro you, then they won't last long in their jobs either. So you really have to read the room in terms of what the culture is. Is that something that's accepted here or not? If you're going to try and do something about it, getting a couple of other people to back you up, and you know, if there's two or three people it happened to as opposed to one, you're always in a much stronger position. But be very, very thoughtful and careful. Make sure you document and really look around and make sure that that is something that can actually work, because in many companies, you know, people will say fine, but the next time there are cuts coming around, you'll be on the list.
And just to go along with that, we have an email. Do you do corporate culture counseling as well as counsel individual employees, is the question?
Yeah, well, I work with certain companies. I advise a couple of startups, and I sometimes work with top leadership in certain companies. I've even advised, you know, the UK government about some things. But yes, but here's the thing. I mean, that sounds terrific, except the people who come for me for that kind of work are people who are open to it in the first place.
Yeah.
They usually, you know, on the better side of things to begin with. Otherwise, they wouldn't. Do you know what I mean? And so it helps. So I always say, you know, people are always open to that when they come to me, but that's why they come to me, because they are.
A listener emailed to say that a great way to de-stress and quiet the mind is through meditation. The listener worked for 45 years in a high-stress job, and meditation has done wonders for them for transitioning from work to home life.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely true. I think meditation is wonderful for that. It helps quiet the mind, and it has many, many usages. One is, yes, to help transition from work to home. If you meditate for a while, and especially if you experience that, so you can actually do it quite effectively. But the other time it's very useful to do is at work. You can meditate in certain breaks. You can take 5 minutes between difficult meetings and kind of meditate, regulate your emotions, kind of restabilize yourself. So meditation is an extremely useful tool. I'm very much for it. I suggest it if people aren't familiar with it. There are many resources online for free that you can get to practice it. It's not that difficult, but it's one of those highly effective tools that you should have in your arsenal.
I was thinking about that one other item you mentioned that I agreed with immediately because I do it myself, and that is a bit of exercise. And it doesn't have to be fancy exercise. And I do a couple mile, 3 mile maybe walk daily.
Yeah. And so that's good when you can do the 3 miles. And sometimes people, even during the workday, if you've been sitting down all day, go up and down some stairs if you have a couple of minutes. Do like a minute of push-ups, just like, you know, get your muscles going, get your mind actually focused on your body rather than on the troubles of the day. So exercise is very, very useful. The best use of it, by the way, is exercise in nature. Because yes. Then you have the double combo of nature and exercise. I unfortunately live in Manhattan. The exercise and nature options are severely limited. but for you guys, I think you have way more options than I. I know the weather can be a limiting factor. But nonetheless, exercise and nature are a great combo.
Our guest, Guy Winch, his book, Mind Over Grind, and the subtitle, How to Break Free When Work Hijacks Your Life. Had some good calls today. If you have a question, comments, or maybe an experience, I hope you'll join in. The number's 800-642-1234, or email us. The email address, talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Coming up at noon today, we'll talk about how a UW-Madison facility at the South Pole is helping solve some of the biggest mysteries of the universe. That's at noon today. Right now, talking with author Guy Winch about his book, Mind Over Grind, How to Break Free When Work Hijacks Your Life. Sarah emailed to say she's paid hourly and works from home. She's expected to respond to emails at all times, but is only paid for her time when executing tasks. With this setup, Sarah's in constant work mode. She has tried walking away from the computer and not being as attentive, but she often finds herself coming back to a flood of work or feeling the pull to check on things. And wondering about advice.
Yeah, I mean, look, I mean, I feel like, are you allowed to go and see, I don't know if you have kids, but go and see their recital? Are you allowed to get a massage? Are you allowed to go swimming? Are you allowed to have a romantic moment? In other words, all of those things are going to happen away from the computer and take you away, and it might take an hour for you to respond. And so it's also, if you are responding, you know, so quickly that you have to be there for every 10 or 15 minutes, then either, you know, then you're also training your employer that, you know, I will be able to do that. But if it takes an hour and somebody says, well, why didn't you respond sooner? I think it's fair to say, I was unavailable. I was busy. Well, what were you doing? That's inappropriate. You know, because again, whether you're having a romantic moment, having a bath, you went swimming, you know, like you're allowed to have a life. And so if it's outside of work hours, you really need to start pushing against the envelope there and like taking more and more time and training yourself to be able to step away from the laptop without feeling anxiety.
Yeah. Jim in Madison has a question for us. Jim, hello.
Hey, hello, Larry. This is a great subject you have today. My question concerns a coworker that got promoted to being the boss. and he's a little insecure, so he's a narcissist. He really puts you down during meetings and things. I think it's mainly because of the insecurity, he's in charge now. He kind of took over for the owner who passed away suddenly. And I was wondering how you handle a coworker / boss like that.
Hmm. I mean, I don't know if you're still on the line. What are they doing that's difficult for you, other than just looking down and feeling insecure and trying to cover for it? What are they doing that's making life more difficult for you?
Since they're the boss, they'll kind of call you out at meetings and stuff, even though it's not your fault, it's their fault. You know, they'll kind of drop the ball for certain customers, and they'll kind of throw it in your lap. Like, why wasn't this done or that? Or, you know, talk to the customer and move things out, and just kind of incompetent. They don't do the job very well. And then I was kind of at the end of the line with the project. So I was ultimately responsible for the success of the project, and I'm kind of covering for them. And so it's a multitude of things that happen.
Yeah. And you actually deal with that in your book. You have a fairly specific example of that in your book.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely there's definitely someone there who deals with these kinds of political situations, but here's the thing. First of all, the things you want to do are really document, because in other words, if you have documentation of like, no, I definitely emailed you about that. Here's the email you might have forgotten. Like, it's about setting boundaries with them when you have the documentation to back it up. Doing it politely, doing it respectfully. You don't want to shame them, because that's not gonna help you necessarily, but you might want to approach them after the meeting and say, hey, you called me out on that, but here's the email. I'm just reminding you, this was something that was, on your plate, not on mine. You need to find ways when you can, show it in black and white to kind of set limits in that way and let them know, like, you can't really say that when that's not true. I will respond to it. It is a tricky situation in general, though, when somebody gets moved up and they're not competent and they're not sufficiently able to do their job, and they're just trying to cover and then blame and project and do those things. It's a difficult transition for all. But to protect yourself, you want to be able to document things, keep things, and again, respond in a way that doesn't shame them publicly, because they are the boss now, but that you can go to them afterwards. And if you do that, they will learn that, let me not put him on the spot again, because he'll then come to me and stand up for himself in ways that he can, because he has it all documented.
Hmm. Interesting. Jim, good luck, and thank you very much for your call. Kevin in Princeton couldn't stay with us. He went to a conference and learned about the turnover of health and childcare workers, and just wonders, what do people in these particular professions face stress-wise that leads to burnout?
Well, compassion fatigue is a lot of what they face, because they, in the health professions, in the mental health professions, in childcare, you deal with a lot of distressed clients. You deal with a lot of people who are going through objectively very heartbreaking, difficult, challenging situations, and you are there to support them, to be with them. So you have to contain that. You have to have empathy for it. And when you're constantly empathizing with people who are really in truly challenging, painful, difficult situations, there's a fatigue that sets in that you don't have that much more compassion to give. You're like running out of it in some way. It's called compassion fatigue. And so it's an additional stressor that people experience. We're social animals, and when somebody, and we're working with them, tells us about a very stressful, unfortunate situations, we feel a measure of that ourselves for them in that empathy, and that can really wear us down over time if we don't know how to manage it effectively.
I was thinking about that in terms that thought just went out of my mind. I'll admit to that. Let me turn to something else. The one point I was going to make, now I remember, it related to childcare workers.
Mm-hmm.
Along with everything else, their pay scales are among the lowest. I mean, they're just not good. They're not they're not being paid for what they have to do.
Right, and that includes teachers a lot of the time, and that includes a lot of kinds of, you know, nurses in many capacities, etc. And these are the kinds of jobs where you are on all the time. You're not sitting in an office where you can take 20 minutes now to start taking care of personal business or to doodle. You know, like this, you know, there's the noise, chaos, this stuff going on all around you. So it's a very, very demanding job. You have to prepare. Teachers never have enough equipment and resources and time. It's extremely challenging.
There are so many things that we're not going to get to even a tenth of all that you talk about in your book, which is so many good pieces of information on how to deal with things. One I liked was the memoir test.
That's about frustrations, and that when you're in a bad mood because something upsetting, frustrating, a setback happened, and people are like, I don't know how to get out of that bad mood. And a lot of the times, you know, and so the memoir test is like, basically ask yourself this: if you at some point in your life write your memoirs about this was my life, is this incident going to make it in? Probably not. Probably not. It was a minor irritation. It seemed really annoying in the moment, but in the grand perspective of your life, it just wasn't significant enough to make it into the memoir. So that memoir test is a good way to get perspective, to kind of zoom out and go like, yeah, it's annoying me right now, but it's like a stubbing of the toe. Like, okay, it's not going to matter tomorrow. It's not going to matter in a week, or it's not going to matter in a year. Therefore, I should really endeavor to let it go.
Yeah. And just reducing the intensity. I mean, you had three. There were three points you made that I thought were good ones. One was shifting your perspective, which is what the memoir kind of does.
Yeah, it shifts your perspective. It kind of reframes the incident as not as significant as it might feel to you in that moment. And by thinking about the memoir part, you're also doing a mental time travel where you're zooming out and seeing the incident from 10, 20, 30 years time. And when we time travel that way, when we zoom out psychologically, we also distance ourselves emotionally. And so that's a brain hack for lessening the emotional impact that you feel in a moment, because you're like gaining that psychological distance, which gives you more emotional distance.
So you're shifting your perspective, and you're finding, and then I like finding a silver lining too.
And you always can, because there's, you know, anything that happens is informative in some way. And if it's not, then it also teaches you like, okay, now I need to figure out how to handle this kind of situation. Or, you know, like the gentleman with the colleague turned boss who's difficult. It's like, yeah, there are obnoxious bosses. They're narcissistic bosses. Like, here's your opportunity to learn how to manage them, how to handle them, how to deal with them in ways that are productive for you, or like mitigate somewhat the annoyance, the aggravation that you would feel. So there's some utility in the practice.
Yeah. And just I want to go to vacations because it's important to take vacations, you say.
Yeah. And the book ends with a chapter about the science of restorative vacations. We all take vacations. They're not always restorative. And it's full of tips for how to make your vacation more useful. I'll mention one that I learned early in practice. And boy, does it make a difference. Do not get to your vacation exhausted. Do not work until 1 a.m. the night before to get ahead. Because then it'll take you 3 or 4 days to relax and enjoy your vacation, by which point half the vacation is over, if not all. And so I actually try and rest up the couple of evenings before I go on vacation. I try to start, you know, lowering the gear, you know, and kind of being more relaxed in a more vacation ready mindset. And when I do that, it's remarkable. I get to that first day of vacation and I'm able to relax right away, as opposed to like, it takes me 2 or 3 days to stop, days to stop thinking about work and gearing down.
Well, I wish we had more time to go through the rest of this, because there are so many helpful tips, and you've given many of them today, but there are many, many more in your book. Thank you so much, Guy, for being with us today. Really appreciate it.
Thank you, and thank you, great listeners.
Guy Winch is our author today, and his book, and he's written other books too, Mind Over Grind is the title of this one. Mind Over Grind, How to Break Free When Work Hijacks Your Life. Coming up, we're going to talk about the Ice Cube Project. How about that? I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Thanks so much for joining us here on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. We are turning our attention to neutrinos, and I bet you know all about neutrinos, or maybe you don't. We're going to learn about neutrinos and something called the Ice Cube Neutrino Observatory. It's at the South Pole and recently underwent a major upgrade. And I think it's exciting. It's an exciting project. I know it's excited a lot of scientists around the world. And our two guests today, researchers at UW-Madison, have both visited the facility in Antarctica many years apart for the two of them. So we'll get a couple different perspectives, I think. One of the folks is UW-Madison physics professor Justin Vandenbroek. Justin, welcome. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me. I'm excited to be here.
Great to have you with us. Also with us today is, and you were there, by the way, what, 20 years maybe ago?
Yeah, over 3 years, about 20 years ago.
Yeah, you were there a long time and did a lot of work over 3 years there. Delaney Butterfield is a UW graduate research assistant, and you were just there not too long ago.
Yeah, I was there all of December and all of January this past field season.
You know, some people would say December and January in Antarctica?
Yeah. So it's actually summer there, believe it or not. Yeah. Not really summer temperatures. Still pretty cold, but yeah, it was Southern Hemisphere, so our seasons are flipped. So
yeah. Yeah, so there you go. Well, we're going to find out about your experiences there as we move along. And as you listen to our two guests, I hope you'll join the conversation. What questions you have about their work, maybe, or maybe about living in Antarctica, how they help maybe build and boost the power of the world's oldest neutrino telescope. Give us a call, the number 800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or you could email us, the email address, talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Justin, let me turn to you first. You know, as we were talking before the show started, I can remember talking about this project almost before it, before it started with UW researchers, and that back in the 90s.
That's right. In the 90s, there was a project led by UW-Madison and collaborators around the world, and that was a project called AMANDA. And the idea was to demonstrate whether this crazy idea of doing astronomy using neutrinos was actually possible. And not only whether it was possible, but whether you could do it in ice rather than water. And basically, people at the time installed these very precision, sensitive light detectors in the ice at the South Pole. And after years in R&D and demonstrating that they could develop and install the technology, they detected neutrinos from the atmosphere.
And so what are neutrinos, Delaney?
Neutrinos are a very small particle. They are nearly massless, so they travel at nearly the speed of light. And they are completely neutral, which means that they aren't deflected at any magnetic fields. And they're also weakly interacting, which is great because that means that they aren't scattered or absorbed as they travel to our detector. But it also means that it's really hard to detect them. So they come in a few different flavors, and they also oscillate between flavors, which is part of the science goals of this recent upgrade that we just installed this past field season. But then they also carry a lot of information about their source and where they come from, and that's where the neutrino astronomy comes into play.
Yeah. So why in the heck are we worried about the? And by the way, are they going through us as we speak?
They are going through us. There's trillions going through us every second.
Oh, my gosh. Well, I don't feel like a piece of Swiss cheese.
That's what Delaney said. They travel straight through us almost all the time. It's very rare that they ever collide with an atom.
Well, why don't we just take pictures of them right here in the studio? Why can't we do that?
So we need a very clear medium to actually be able to see the neutrinos, because when they interact, they, so like an ice cube, for example, these neutrinos are traveling through the ice. They'll interact with the ice and then create a secondary particle. And that particle is going to be traveling faster than the speed of light in ice. And that's going to create kind of a sonic boom, but with light. And that's called Cherenkov radiation, which is like a blue flash of light. And so that's what we actually see. So when they're traveling through us, they're probably not interacting. And even if they were, we wouldn't be able to see that Cherenkov light because we need that really clear medium, which for us is the Antarctic ice.
And that ice is there's a reason why that Antarctic ice is good ice to view this, Justin.
Right. When you think about the fact that most of these neutrinos travel straight through people and straight through everything, it's very rare that they hit an atom, as I mentioned, and so you need a lot of atoms. And as Delaney explained, the way that we detect these neutrinos is when they shatter an atom, they eventually make a flash of detectable light. And so you need to monitor a huge number of atoms in an optically clear, transparent material. And so when you think about where can you find huge numbers of atoms in an optically clear material, the ice at the South Pole is among the best places in the world to do this.
And, you know, when I look at the ice cubes in my freezer, they're not as clear as I'd like them to be. So there's a lot of air in that, if I'm not mistaken. But the ice at the South Pole is crushed a little bit more than the ice that's in my freezer.
Yeah, that ice fell originally as snow. It's a desert, but it does snow a bit. And the snow, of course, is very white, just like the snow we're used to in Wisconsin. And more snow falls on top of that. It eventually compresses that snow. It gradually compresses it over many years into ice. That ice initially is just like the ice in the freezer. It's full of bubbles. And that's milky white. It's not useful at all for neutrino astronomy. But as the snow on top keeps falling, eventually those bubbles are compressed and compressed. Eventually they go into solution inside the solid ice, and it becomes crystal clear.
It's an amazing, especially when you get down a mile and a half.
Yep, that's how deep Ice Cuba is.
It's amazing that there's that much. I mean, is the ice even deeper than a mile and a half? Are you going right to the bottom? Or I know Antarctica is, there's land there. The North Pole is different. It does not have land under it, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, there's about 10,000 feet of ice, 9,000 to 10,000 feet of ice at the South Pole.
So 2 miles, or closer to 2 miles,
yep,
than a mile and a half. Actually, Trevor in Appleton has a question for you. Let's go there. Trevor, hi.
Hi there. Can you hear me all right?
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, cool. So really great to hear from Justin and Delaney. Excited to hear about this show. So I studied architecture at the School of the Art Institute of Chicago, and one of our architectural studio projects was to study Arctic ice with the goal of designing, fabricating, and installing long-term research facilities in that environment. So just curious to hear from Justin and Delaney what their experience was in terms of the built environment when they were doing their research.
Ah, interesting. So what have you got down there for, you know, you just don't, it's not like the original folks down there that were trying to get to the pole with dog sleds and use tents.
Yeah, when I was there working on construction of the original ice cube array, that was between 2005 and 2008, there was the iconic dome, the geodesic dome that a lot of people have probably seen in photos, and that was being demolished in those years, and there was a gradual transition to the new station, which you might have also seen photos of. It's a modular, modern structure with windows. Looks like a basically normal building, but in a remote outpost. And that's a great facility now for living and working at the South Pole. Maybe Delaney can explain her experience.
Yeah, talk some more about it.
Yeah, so one really interesting thing about all of the buildings at the South Pole is they're all on, like, stilts. So every few years, they go through a cycle of raising all of the buildings because the snow accumulation.
Oh.
So like every few years, or maybe longer than a few years, but they'll have to like raise the station so that the snow accumulation doesn't like cover it up. Same with the Ice Cube Lab over in what we call the dark sector, which is where all of the astronomy goes on at the South Pole. All of the buildings in the dark sector get raised periodically. So yeah, but the station is great. It's just like kind of a big dormitory, but there's a gym, there's reading rooms, there's places to watch movies. It's definitely not the worst place to be stuck for a few months.
So that, and that's in the quote, quote, summer of December and January. How's it heated? I mean, I was thinking, oh, you could probably use solar down there for some of it because it's that time of the year, it's light the whole time. Is it not, or am I wrong?
Yes, it is light. 24 hours of daylight. Yeah. In the summer months.
In the summer months. So how are the buildings heated? I mean, what's the temperature first?
The temperature, when I was there this past field season, ranged, the air temperature fluctuated a little bit, but the feels like temperature with the wind and everything ranged from like minus 30 to minus 50 most days, averaging about minus 40.
Well, it's warm.
Yeah,
not real warm. not real warm. I mean, is the place insulated? I may be testing. You know, this is probably nothing that you have thought too much about, but I was just curious.
Yeah, it's very well insulated.
Yeah, I would think so. And how do you? How are the basic supplies handled? I mean, you got to have, do you melt some of the ice for water or what, how does that work?
Yeah, so we get all of our like food and supplies for the station on cargo. So most of it will be either flown or on a vessel to McMurdo Station on Ross Island, which is off the coast of Antarctica on the Ross Ice Shelf. And then from McMurdo, it will go via C-130 or LC-130, or Overland Traverse to the South Pole. And that's how we get all of our, like, cargo and supplies.
And it's traversed, I suppose, some sort of caterpillar-type?
Yeah, so there's, like, modules, like, little houses, kind of, that they pull that the Overland Traverse team lives in and sleeps in. And it takes about a month to get from McMurdo Station to the South Pole via the Overland Traverse. That's how we got a lot of our equipment for the installation. So it's not just station cargo. It's also research materials.
Research materials as well. Louise in Dodgeville has a question that more to the point of neutrinos, I believe. Let's go there. Hi, Louise.
Hi. I had a question about dark matter. And if neutrinos are dark matter, and if they're not, if your guest could explain what dark matter is?
Ah,
that's a great question. So dark matter makes up a large fraction of the universe. It's actually more matter than the visible matter, the normal matter that we see every day. And basically, we can measure its imprints throughout the universe through its gravitational effects. It interacts normally in terms of gravity, but as far as we can tell, it does not interact any other way. So scientists around the world in lots of different projects are trying to figure out if it does interact in other ways. And that's one thing we're working on with Ice Cube. If the dark matter is made of subatomic particles, as some people think it is, then it might decay or annihilate with its own antimatter, that could also be a type of dark matter, to produce neutrinos and other particles that we could detect.
So, Louise, does that help?
Yeah, thank you so much.
And the next question is, why does it matter?
Why do neutrinos matter?
Yeah.
So the whole crazy idea of neutrino astronomy is that most astronomy that we've been doing since, you know, humans were looking up at the sky is using visible light and then extending that into non-visible light throughout the electromagnetic spectrum. That includes ultraviolet, infrared, even radio waves, X-rays, and so on. You can do astronomy with the entire electromagnetic spectrum, every type of visible and non-visible light. But the idea of neutrino astronomy is using other particles, neutrinos in this case, to do astrophysics using neutrinos. So in the same way that X-rays enable you to see deep inside of objects, Neutrinos are like super X-rays. We can see even deeper into the most extreme and most obscured environments in the universe.
So you can get everywhere. Astrophysics, somebody always has a question relating to that. What is it?
Astrophysics is the study of the stars and the contents of the universe, including the lives and deaths of stars and black holes of all sizes, some comparable to stars, some massive, up to millions and billions of times the mass of stars.
Well, we are I'm having fun. I hope our guests are having fun. And I hope you're having fun, too, as you listen into our discussion today as we talk about the Ice Cube Particle Astrophysics Center at the UW-Madison's Physics Department. There, the UW was the lead on this, and I want to get to also talk about this kind of a worldwide thing in many ways, and we'll get to that as well. You may have a question, too, and if you do, or maybe a comment, I hope you'll join in. The number is 800-642-1234. Or email us, the email address, talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Great to have you with us today as we talk with Justin Vandenbroek, a physics professor at the Wisconsin Ice Cube Particle Astrophysics Center at UW-Madison. Works out of the physics department. He helped build the Ice Cube Neutrino Observatory at the South Pole. I think you were a grad student at the time, weren't you?
I was, yeah. I started grad school and learned about the Ice Cube project and got the opportunity to go help build it at the South Pole.
Well, and here we have a current graduate student, Delaney Butterfield, as well. Delaney, a grad research assistant at the Astrophysics Center, and recently returned from the South Pole, where she helped upgrade the Neutrino Observatory. And I want to learn some more about, obviously, we want to learn some more about that as we move along today. If you have a question or comment, I see we have some coming in. Give a call at 800-642-1234. Email to talk@WPR.org. And you know what? Let's go to Jeff and Barry Mills, who has, an interesting question, too. Jeff, hi.
Good morning. Or good afternoon, I'm sorry. I was wondering how those neutrinos move. Are we bombarded from outer space, or do they move horizontally on the Earth's surface in waves, or individually, or, I mean, how close are they together? What kinds of questions like that?
Yeah, interesting. How do they travel, kind of, I guess?
Yeah, so neutrinos are particles, like we've been talking about, and there's also a lot of them. I mean, we were talking earlier about how there are trillions passing through us at each second. And because they are neutral, they travel pretty much in a straight line from their source, meaning that we, when we detect them, can point them back to where they came from using reconstruction techniques in our like algorithms and analysis.
So they're coming, could they be coming from all directions, though? I mean, they're straight line, but
yeah.
Talk about that.
Yeah, so they could come from any direction. Ice Cube sees neutrinos that pass through the Earth. We also see them from what we call the southern sky, which is the sky above the South Pole. So yeah, any direction.
Very cool. There you go, Jeff. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. Bobby called, couldn't stay with us. She wants to know where neutrinos originate from.
That's what I spend a lot of my waking hours wondering about. As Delaney mentioned, we can see them from not just the sky overhead at the South Pole, as you would with a normal telescope, but also from the northern sky going all the way through the Earth. And so we've measured neutrinos as basically a constant glow coming from throughout the universe, mostly from beyond our galaxy. We also recently discovered that the galaxy itself glows brightly in neutrinos. And for the most part, we don't know what's producing either the extragalactic or the galactic glow of neutrinos. We have identified a handful of sources, which are giant black holes very distant from the galaxy. But it's an outstanding mystery what's producing most of these neutrinos, and that's what one of the things we're busy working on.
Yeah. So the trillion that just hit me a second ago, How long did it take those neutrinos to get to me?
So the trillions that we mentioned, okay, there are two. That's the speaking generally about neutrinos.
Of course.
So about half of those come from the sun, from the fusion processes that we know happen in the sun. Another half are left over from the Big Bang. And actually, Ice Cube is not directly studying either of those. We're studying much more energetic ones, much more energetic than humans can produce at our particle accelerators. And those ones can take millions to billions of years to reach us from their sources in these black holes or other origins.
A long, long time. Faith in Reedsburg, what's on your mind?
I was wondering if you're seeing any more or less color that we would see with our eyes in the color spectrum, or maybe it is just a black hole, or is it white? Is it a white light? Is there a light? Any kind of different colors in the spectrum?
Actually, Delaney, let's go to Delaney for that.
Yeah, so when we talk about neutrino astronomy, this is in the sort of topic of multi-messenger astronomy, which is doing astronomy with more than just light. So we were talking earlier about how historically astronomy has been done by looking up at the sky and seeing what's up there, basically. And we can also see that in X-rays and UVs. So neutrino astronomy is sort of like looking at the sky and detecting things in light. But instead of light, it's a particle. So not exactly a color like you were asking, but similar in the sense that we can map these objects and study these astrophysical objects, but now with a particle instead of a photon.
So tell us about the project, Delaney, maybe you can talk about this now. Here we had Justin was building the first one, and you said to yourself, well, we could do better than that. I don't know that it went quite that way, but I mean, tell us about what was going on and why we needed to sort of update, I guess.
Yeah, so the upgrade is designed to target lower energy neutrino physics. So the upgrade, or the original Ice Cube Array, targets higher energy neutrinos above 1 TeV. I'm not really sure how to contextualize that energy unit, but above 1 TeV. And the upgrade, which is a denser infill array inside the original 86 string array, is really designed to target lower energies in the GeV range. And so this dense instrumentation is to be able to more efficiently detect less light. So if we have a lower energy particle, it's not going to produce as much light. And these lower energy neutrinos are where the neutrino oscillations happen. So we can study more about the actual properties of the particle versus the higher energy is really where we're studying, like, where they come from. So it's sort of a shift in focus in terms of the science goals, but they all work together very closely.
Yeah, I would think so. But the goal with this new setup, though, I mean, how is it going to help in our understanding of the universe?
Sure, yeah. So things that we don't fully understand about neutrinos yet are their mass, because they are very small.
Yeah.
So we actually can't, or we haven't measured their masses directly. Instead, we have what we call a mass ordering, which is the masses of the neutrinos in relation to each other. We also don't know exactly how they oscillate, so how they change what we call flavors. So understanding like their oscillation patterns more can also help us understand more about the particle itself. So because these are weakly interacting and very small, these parameters are very difficult to measure and detect directly.
And I want to go back. We've talked about the array a bit, but I don't think we really, and that's on me, we really didn't describe what this kind of looks like in at the South Pole. And so, Justin, go ahead and talk about that, because you've got a pretty large area, reasonably speaking, I think.
A very large area. It's called Ice Cube because it's a cubic kilometer of ice. So imagine a kilometer distance and then cube that. That's enough volume of ice to contain a billion tons of ice. So when we talked earlier about how it's very improbable that any neutrino hits an atom, that's why you need such a huge volume to have so many atoms that you can monitor for neutrino collisions. And when one of these neutrinos occasionally collides with an atom, it shatters it, and those fragments of the atom make a flash of light. And we have this array of 5,000 sensors in the ice. That was before this new upgrade. Now there's much more. And those sensors in the ice have what are called photomultiplier tubes. They're kind of like light bulbs in reverse. They convert a flash of light into a flash of electricity. And we record that at this array, and we can use that to calculate where each neutrino came from on the sky.
And we're not talking about digging a little hole in the ice here.
Right. Each hole is about a mile and a half deep. That's why you have to go so deep, first, to span such a large volume, and second, to get below those bubbly, that bubbly section of ice that's more shallow that we talked about earlier. There's also a huge background of other subatomic particles coming from the atmosphere all the time. And the deeper you go, the more you avoid that background noise.
That makes sense. Well, I thought it was cool is how you get down a mile and a half.
Yeah, it's pretty simple. You just...
simple
in concept, very challenging in engineering. So that was the major success of the Ice Cube project, that the engineering triumph of doing this at such a large scale in such a difficult environment. So this was a collaboration between the Wisconsin Ice Cube Particle Astrophysics Center that you mentioned earlier and the Physical Sciences Lab, also at UW in Stoughton. And they designed this, it's called the Enhanced Hot Water Drill, and it's basically a means of producing hot water at as high temperature and pressure as you can, and then just squirting it in the ice. And you just keep squirting, keep heating, keep squirting, and you get this, in only a couple days, you get a hole that's a mile and a half deep.
And you were down there for that, weren't you, Delaney?
Yeah, so I got to the South Pole on December 1st of this past winter. And when I got there, we were actually trying to, like, prep the drill, or the drill team was trying to, like, prep the drill to commence drilling for the upgrade. Because a lot of this equipment is very old from the days of Amanda, older than I am.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a huge undertaking just to, like, get this equipment back in shape to drill more holes. So the drill team did a great job getting that prepped. But yeah, it took a few days to actually drill the holes, because in addition to going down, you also have to come back up, get the drill head out, and then it took a full 24 hours for the installation team, which I was a part of, to get the devices in the hole and lower the string. So all in all, it took, like, I think between 4 and 5 days on average to drill the hole and finish installing it.
And you know, when you drill a hole, I mean, and it's 40 below zero, the hole, you know, I've done a lot of ice fishing, you know, and the holes freeze up pretty quick, even at 20 degrees Fahrenheit, let alone 40 below.
Yeah, so part of the enhanced hot water drill is the immense amount of pressure that it's under, or that the water is under. So we're drilling at about 200 gallons per minute, which is a lot of water, and also at about 80 degrees Celsius, which is just below boiling. I mean, boiling is 100. So that combination, and also our team of engineers has multiple thermal models on, like, how this hole should look, what the rate of drilling should be. So this is very well studied in terms of how long does the hole need to be drilled? How long will the hole be what we call like alive? Like what's the live time of the hole? So how long do we have before we can no longer install our devices in it? And then it actually takes a few weeks for the hole to completely freeze, just because it is so deep.
Yeah.
So it actually kind of freezes upside down. So it freezes from the top bottom generally, because the surface is actually much colder than the bottom, because the bottom of the hole is closer to the earth. So we have the heat from the earth kind of like warming up the bottom of the ice.
But I'm still, and I want to get to Sitch in just a second here, but I'm still amazed at how do you get down a mile and a half? Do you have a long hose that's, I mean, you actually run a hose of water?
Yeah, we have a massive spool that's behind our drilling and installation tower that goes over the tower and into the hose. It's over a mile and a half long. Yeah, it's made up of segments that are coupled together, but it is a very long hose.
It is indeed. Let's go to, I've got some more on that, but let's go to Sitch in Madison. Thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Sure. Thanks for taking my call. I am wondering how fast neutrinos travel and also how they get accelerated to that speed in the first place.
Yeah, so neutrinos have almost zero, but not quite zero mass. And that means that they travel almost at the speed of light. So for all practical purposes, you can say they travel at the speed of light. It's a smidge below the speed of light. And how do they get accelerated? So as Delaney explained earlier, they don't have electric charge. And so you cannot accelerate them using the usual methods of electric and magnetic fields that we use in human-constructed particle accelerators. They're produced by other energetic particles. So one of the main purposes of IceCube is to understand the cosmic particle accelerators that we know are abundant in the universe and reach energies millions of times more energetic than humans have figured out how to achieve. And those energetic particles called cosmic rays, they produce neutrinos either while they're traveling across the universe or directly in their sources. So it's the neutrinos reach high energies because they're the particles from which they originate are accelerated to very high energies.
So at the speed of light, and you were talking earlier that it might take a million years for a neutrino at the speed of light to make it to my hand here as I put my hand up, might have been from a million years ago.
A million or even a billion. So if you think
even
about,
a billion.
Yeah, some of these giant black holes we've detected are a billion light years away. And so that neutrino started its journey a billion years ago when, you know, early in the Earth's evolution, and then that evolution continued, life evolved, humans evolved, astronomers evolved, then particle physicists evolved. Luckily, they constructed IceCube in time for that flash of neutrinos to arrive after traveling a billion years across the universe.
Amazing story. Dana emailed to ask what scientists observed in neutrinos during the close flyby of 31 Atlas comet in December? Is there anything that you would have?
I think that's the one that the Vera Rubin Observatory detected. It's the latest of these interstellar objects that are very exciting in terms of their astronomy. As far as I know, they don't have a direct connection to IceCube and neutrino astronomy.
Jeff wonders, do they collide? Do neutrinos collide? And if they do, what happens?
Neutrinos are weakly interacting, like I have mentioned a few times. So they do collide with atoms in the ice. That's what creates the interaction that IceCube detects. As far as colliding with each other, Justin, do you know more about that?
In principle, they can collide with one another. It would be a very rare event, but like any other particles, they could collide and produce other particles.
So, and they, the ones that just went through me, they're on their way somewhere else. And are they ever going to, I mean, what's, do we know? Do they ever stop? I mean, there's got to be some kind of energy, isn't there, to move them along?
Yeah, the ones traveling through our body, as we discussed earlier, most of them are from the sun or from the Big Bang, and they're very low energy.
Yeah.
And at those low energies, they're the least likely to interact. So they can travel, even if you imagine a giant planet or a giant star, they could travel light years through a star or a planet. It boggles the mind. So they travel, you know, these huge distances. But if you have enough atoms that you're monitoring, you can still detect them at these low energies. So, for example, neutrinos have been detected from the sun, and that's part of how we understand how the sun works and also how we understand the particle physics of neutrinos. At the very high energies where Ice Cube operates, they're much more likely to interact. So, for example, at the highest energies we study, they actually can't travel even all the way through the Earth.
Got it. We're talking today about the Ice Cube project and actually the Ice Cube Neutrino Observatory at the South Pole with our two guests, Eleni Butterfield and Justin Vandenberg. And it's great to have them with us. Questions for them? I hope you'll join in. We've had a lot of great questions here so far. What about you? Give a call at 1-800-642-1234, or you could email us to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Great to have you with us here on WPR News as we talk with Eleni Butterfield and Justin Vandenberg about the Ice Cube Particle Astrophysics Center and the Ice Cube Neutrino Observatory at the South Pole. And again, join in with your own thoughts at 800-642-1234. Eleni, I saw a photo of you, I even mentioned this earlier, of you with one of the sensors. Sensors look to be, what, 4 foot, maybe 3 foot, something like that?
Yeah, and, something like that.
And they look conical?
Sort of egg-shaped?
Egg-shaped is the word. Egg-shaped is the word. And as I looked at that picture and I thought, you know, you're dropping that thing a mile and a half down into, I don't know how many tons of pressure would be down there. And they better work.
Yeah.
Because you're not going to get them back up, right?
Yeah, exactly. So all of our devices are rated, pressure rated, up to 10,000 PSI, because that is the level that we've seen the pressure spike to in Friesen for Ice Cube, the original Ice Cube deployment. So all of the devices that went into the upgrade were tested and rated up to 10,000 PSI, in addition to all of the extreme temperatures that they will face at the South Pole.
What do they use for material? I mean,
yeah,
you're not going to get this at the local sporting goods store.
So all of the glass is borosilicate glass. So they're all of our devices are housed in glass pressure vessels, which we source through a few different companies. One of them is based out of Germany. One of them is based out of Japan. Borosilicate glass, very strong and can withstand extreme pressure.
Yeah. Have any of them, Justin, ever broken? I mean, down there? How was it? I mean, it's been 20 years or better.
Since we've constructed Ice Cube 15 years ago, we've lost communication with something like 1% of all of the sensors. So, you know, 99% are still working fine after all these years under those huge pressures.
That's absolutely amazing to me. I'm it shows too that there obviously a heck of a lot of thought went into the how to construct these and then to test them and so that sort of thing before they went down, if you had that little of a loss. Barry in Madison has a question. Barry, hi.
Yes, I may have missed, you may have just been discussing my question, and that is how the collection devices are set up and I guess a description somehow just how they operate. And I just want to mention to Justin that, if I'm not mistaken, one of his colleagues 20 years ago was probably a young woman by the name of Kira, because she's a friend of mine, and she was involved in the neutrino thing in Antarctica, I don't know if that rings a bell.
Yeah, Kira does not ring a bell, but that's one of the great things working on this project. It's hundreds of people around the world, and we get to work with so many of them, get to know them, but that Kira does not ring a bell.
Well, what about the part of that Barry was asking was how do you collect or how's the data collection process? How does that work?
Yeah, so each of our digital optical modules in the ICE is made up of, for the original Ice Cube DOMs, one photomultiplier tube, which is an electronic device that can convert a photon or light into an electronic pulse. So that DOM will read the photon and then send it to the surface, what we call our main cable assembly, where it can be analyzed and sent over the satellite to the north. In the upgrade, all of our devices have more than one photomultiplier tube. They have multiple, which is part of the reason that the upgrade is aimed at like low energy physics,
mm-hmm.
Because it's so much more dense. But they operate in the same way. So the light travels through the ice, and will be collected by that photomultiplier tube, converted into an electronic pulse, and then sent to the surface to be analyzed.
Pretty cool. Pretty cool. Chris in Evansville. Hi, Chris.
Hi. I was just wondering, you know, are we someday, when humans may be living on the moon, are we going to get the same type of bombardment by neutrinos? Are they intergalactic? Do we need them to live in a healthy manner?
Yeah. Well, that's a big question for you there, Justin.
Yeah, so you can think of the neutrinos as being among what's called cosmic rays or cosmic radiation, most of which is energetic atomic nuclei, protons and heavier nuclei. The neutrinos are another type of naturally occurring radiation. However, as we've discussed, they're very unlikely to ever hit an atom, so they don't pose any human health challenges.
Hmm, interesting. Lori, thanks, Chris. Appreciate it. Lori in Menasha, your turn. Hi, Lori.
Hi, thanks for taking my call, sure. And it's such an awesome discussion. My questions were coming back to the facility itself, and I wondered, are you guys able to grow any kind of plant material, and is it at all possible to be self-sustaining there? Do you use renewable energy of any certain type that's fashioned for the facility? And my last question was, what do you think about the Project Hail Mary science? Because that was pretty interesting, too. And thank you.
All right. Thanks for calling.
So there's a small greenhouse at South Pole Station. That's about it in terms of, like, if we are self-sustainable, because South Pole is not habitable. There are no animals there. We saw a bird early in this season, and everyone was like, oh, my gosh.
A bird.
We see life. so that was kind of funny. But, yeah, so South Pole itself is actually not a place that life can be sustained, except on station. So all of our like food and stuff gets sent in via cargo. And then there's a small greenhouse for the people who stay there over the winter so that they can have like fresh vegetables and stuff over the winter.
Yeah, there are people that stay year round.
Yes, not me, but there are people.
Yeah. John, I was going to ask a question, but I see John's got a good one, so let's go there. John, hi, in Mason.
Hi, I have a quick question. You may have answered it already, but I didn't hear it. Were neutrinos first theorized, or were they just discovered, and by whom?
Yeah.
Yeah, so neutrinos were theorized for a while, before they were actually discovered. So we've talked a little bit about the different sources of neutrinos, the different types and the different energy ranges. And one of the sources of neutrinos is in a radioactive decay. And that is how they were first discovered, was from a radioactive decay experiment. Justin, I don't know if you want to add anything to that.
Yeah, it was actually at a nuclear reactor. So neutrinos are produced abundantly at nuclear reactors, and they were discovered there for the first time in the 1950s, about 20 years after being theorized, theoretically, by Wolfgang Pauli.
And we did mention kind of in passing, but there, I mean, the UW leads this project, but it's a world. I mean, talk about the worldwide reach of this in terms of work.
Yeah, that's one of the fun things about it. So it's over 450 authors on our papers now, and a lot of those people I've known as friends for 20 years now, and meeting new ones all the time. They're spread among 58 institutions on 14 countries. So it's a privilege to be here working at UW-Madison, which is the headquarters, and also to work with all those collaborators around the world.
Elisa emailed to ask if Delaney or Justin would go back to the South Pole, and if so, why?
I would go in a heartbeat. It was so much fun being down there. The people are amazing. The work is really hard, but it's really interesting, fulfilling work. And there's no place like it. I loved it there.
Yeah.
Me too. It's just a lot of fun to work hands-on. As a physicist, we spend a lot of our days working on very abstract thoughts and concepts and computer programming. But that's why I'm an experimental physicist, is to also do hands-on work with my hands.
Yeah, it's got to be a fascinating and fantastic experience. What's the largest, Mark wants to know from Duluth, what's the largest object we've discovered or observed in space? And Justin, what do you think?
I'll focus on mass rather than size. Paradoxically, some of the brightest objects in the universe are actually black holes, and they can grow to be millions or even billions of times the mass of the sun. It's a big mystery how they grow to be so large, so massive, and they act as particle accelerators, and that's one of the main things we're studying, is why these giant black holes, how they can act as particle accelerators. And we've detected some that are up to almost a billion times the mass of the sun with IceCube.
Oh. And that's one of the virtues, I guess, of Ice Cube, isn't it?
Exactly.
What do you hope? I mean, down the road, you know, you're just kind of, in a way, Delaney, just getting started. You're probably going to be working on this. I won't be here 20 years from now to talk with you about this, but whoever takes my place might be.
Yeah, I've worked on the upgrade for my entire physics research career. So 1 year of my undergrad, and then I'm now almost 4 years into my PhD. So it was really, that's part of the reason it was so great to be down there and see it go into the ice. And I would just love to stay connected to the upgrade in any way I can throughout the rest of my PhD, whatever I do after my PhD. I really love the science that Ice Cube does, both the low energy side and the high energy side. I love working for the collaboration, and I think that Ice Cube is kind of just getting started.
And hopefully with funding and so forth, there are some rumblings about funding at the NSF and so forth. Hopefully we can keep that going.
Yeah, so building on the success of the construction of the IceCube upgrade that we've been discussing just in the last few months, we have a concept, a vision of a much larger upgrade to IceCube called IceCube Gen 2, IceCube Generation 2. And the idea is that we've made some major discoveries with IceCube. We've discovered that the universe itself is glowing from beyond the galaxy. The galaxy itself is glowing, but we don't know what's producing this glow. And so we need a much bigger detector to get beyond this tip of the ice cube, so to speak.
Okay. On that note, thank you both very much for being with us today. I really appreciate it. Justin Vandenbroek and Delaney Butterfield have been both working on this project, and it's great to learn more about it. And I appreciate their time, and I appreciate you listening in, and thank you so much for that, and of course the work of our team. I'm Larry Mehler, and you are listening to WPR News. Stay with us. Lots more in store.